Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast, to another of our occasional crossover episodes with our YouTube channel, where the bulk of our exploring sessions now live. It means that on the podcast, we'll be able increasingly to focus on more full cast audio and higher quality audio work. Over on the YouTube channel, we now have first and second look read-throughs of pretty much every play written prior to 1599, though there are a few gaps filled in by the podcast. But even though most of this material is now happening on YouTube, I like to make sure that there's the odd exploring session shared on the podcast to keep a toe in both worlds. This is a second look exploring session of The Tragedy of Iphigenia by Lady Lumley, translated from Euripides during the reign of Queen Mary. It's a second look, so we're going to read through the play at pace and then discuss it at the end, and there's quite a fruitful discussion at the end. But I will now hand you over from future Robert to past Robert, who hosted this session last year. Hello and welcome to this second look, fast-paced read-through, looking at the tragedy of Euripides called Iphigenia, translated by Jane Lady Lumley. We've done a first look exploring session looking at this. We've discussed it to a certain degree. We've decided to come back at it, give it another dusting off and see how it works without stopping and starting. I don't know how much stopping and starting we did last time, actually, but we've made a few minor adjustments to the text, but nothing actually vast, just a few minor tweaks, and people have had a little time to accommodate the fact that there are massive, massive speeches that they need to be prepared for. The amount of preparation that we've been able to do has been relatively small, so we're going to just see what comes out of it this time. Reading today, the part of Agamemnon is...
Sarah Blake, actor, writer and director in Germany.
Reading the part of Clytemnestra today is...
Hi, my name's Elizabeth Amisu and I'm an author based in Romford.
Reading Menelaus is...
Alan Scott, based in Suffolk.
Reading Iphigenia is...
Rachel, actor on the East Coast.
Reading Achilles is...
Hi, I'm Eric and I'm only vulnerable in one part of my body.
Reading Senex is...
Hello, my name is Lynn Freitas. I'm a teacher. I live in the northwestern United States.
And reading Nuncius is...
Hello, I'm Helen Good. I'm a historian and I'm in Hull.
And I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and I will be reading the chorus, though in Lumley's version, the chorus is not as large a presence as it would have been in the Euripides original. There are significant variations between what Euripides wrote and what Lady Lumley decided to produce. So it's always interesting to see how that plays out. We found some fascinating resonances last time, some really interesting choices. I'm always in favour of doing horrible things to choruses, but that's just me. Other people disagree. So without further ado, we're going to read at pace and then discuss at the end this play. So all that remains is for me to step away for the moment until I read a part. Take a little in-breath. Here beginneth the tragedy of Euripides called... Iphigenia.
Come hither, O thou old man.
I come, but what is the matter, O king?
I shall know anon.
I make haste to come, for my old age is very quick and ready, for both the strength of my limbs and also the sight of mine eyes doth yet continue.
But what meaneth this? He thinks I see a star shoot?
It may be so indeed, for it is not yet midnight, as it may be judged by the course of the seven stars.
I think so too, for I hear no noise of birds, neither of the sea, nor of yet the wind. Now all things now are quiet and rest.
What is the cause, O king, that at this time of night thou comest abroad? For all they that be of this haven take their rest still, yea, and the watchmen as yet are not come from the walls. Wherefore I think it meet to go in.
Oh, thou old man, thou seemest unto me to be very happy. For truly I do think that mortal man to be very fortunate which being without honour, doth lead his life quietly. I cannot judge their estate to be happy, which rule in honour.
In these things the glory and renown of man's life doth chiefly consist.
But this renown is very brittle. For to wish for dignity, it seemeth very pleasant, but it vexeth them that obtain it. For sometimes the gods, not truly honoured, take vengeance of man's life, and otherwhiles against men's minds with care and thought to bring their matters to pass are wonderfully troubled.
I do not praise this opinion in a noble man, for, O Agamemnon, thou wast not born to have all things chance haply unto thee. For seeing thou art a mortal man, thou must sometimes rejoice and sometimes again be sorry. For whether you will or no, this must needs happen, because it is so appointed by the gods. But methinks you are writing a letter by candlelight? What is this writing? That you have your hand so, which sometimes you tear, and then write again. Otherwhiles you scale it and anon unseal it, lamenting and weeping. For you seem to make such sorrow as though you were out of your wit. What is the matter, O king? What is the matter? If you will show it me, I shall tell it. You shall tell it to a trusty man and faithful. For thou knowest me to be one that Tyndarus, thy wife's father, sent with her as part of her dowry, because he thought me to be a messenger meet for such a spouse.
Thou knowest that Leda, Thyestes' daughter, had three daughters, Phoebes and Clytemnestra, whom I married, and Helena, whom many noble men desired to have to their wives. But her father, Tyndarus, considering what great destruction was threatened to them that obtained her, doubted long whether he should give her in marriage to any of them or no. Wherefore, because he desired to have all things to happen prosperously, he caused all the young men that desired to marry his daughter to come all together into the temple, and there to make a promise, each to the other before the gods, that if any man, either Grecian or else barbarian, would go about to take Helena from him, whom she chose to be her husband, that then they all would, with cruel battle, take vengeance of that man. And this being thus brought to pass, Tyndarus gave her free liberty to choose among them all whom she liked best. And she chose Menelaus. But I would to God it had not happened. For within a while after, Paris, who, as the common voice saith, was judged between the gods of their beauty, came to Lacedaemon. And he, being a goodly young man and of noble parentage, began to fall in love with her. And so, taking her privily away, brought her to a little village upon the hill Ida. But as soon as these news were brought to Menelaus, he, being as one half out of his wit for anger, began to rehearse the covenant which he and divers other noblemen had made betwixt them at the desire of Tyndarus, saying that it was meet that they then should help him, seeing as he was oppressed with such a manifest injury. And the Grecians, being wonderfully moved with his pitiful complaint, decreed that they all would, with battle, invade the Trojans, which so wrongfully had taken away Helen. Wherefore, after that they had prepared weapons, horses, chariots, and all other things necessary for battle, they chose me to be their captain, because I was Menelaus's brother. But I would that this honour had happened to some other in my place. For now, we having gathered together our host and prepared ourselves ready to battle, are constrained to tarry here idle at this haven, because the winds being against us, we can sail no further. And Colchus, the prophesier, studying long what should be the cause of it and occasion, at length hath answered that if my daughter Iphigenia be slain and sacrificed to the goddess Diana, that then the whole host shall not only have free passage to Troy, but also victoriously conquer it. But without the death of my daughter, none of all these things can be brought to pass. As soon as I heard of this, I commanded that the host should be sent home again, for I answered that my daughter should never be slain through my consent. But I, using all manner of means to persuade my brother to the contrary, yet notwithstanding I was so moved with his earnest desire that at length, agreeing to his cruel request, wrote a letter to my wife that she should send my daughter hither. And because she should be the better willing to let her go, I feigned that she should be married to Achilles, because he was so desirous of her that he denied to go to battle without he might have her to his wife. So that now I have determined the death of my daughter under the colour of marriage. And none knoweth of this save only Menelaus, Calchas, and Ulysses. But now I repenting me of the message which I wrote to my wife of, have here in this letter denied all that I said before. So that if you will carry this letter unto Greece, I will declare unto you all that is contained in it, because I know you to be a faithful servant, both to my wife and me.
Show me, I pray you, what answer I shall make to your wife, agreeable to the letter.
Tell her that she shall not need at this time to send my daughter hither, for her marriage shall be deferred unto another time.
Will not Achilles think you be angry for that under the color of him you have determined the death of your daughter?
Achilles beareth the name only, but he is not partaker of the thing. Neither knoweth he what craft we go about.
Thou hast prepared grievous things, O king, for thou hast determined to sacrifice thine own child under the color of marriage.
Alas, I was then wonderfully deceived, for the which I am now marvelously troubled. Wherefore, I pray thee, make haste, and let not thy old age hinder thee in this journey.
I make haste to go, O king.
Do not stay by the pleasant springs, and tarry not under the shadowing trees, neither let any sleep hinder thee.
Do not you think any such slothfulness in me, O king.
I pray you mark well the way, and look about it diligently, lest that my wife, preventing you, happen to come hither with my daughter in the meantime.
It shall be done, even so.
Make haste, I pray thee, and if thou meet my wife, turn her back again.
But what shall I do, that your wife and your daughter may believe me?
Deliver them this token, which is enclosed in this letter. Go, quickly, for the day beginneth to appear. I pray thee, help me now in this matter. For there is no man to whom all things have chanced happily.
What is this? Methinks I see Menelaus striving with Agamemnon's servant.
Darest thou, O Menelaus, commit so grievous an offence in taking away those letters, which is neither meet, neither lawful, that thou should see?
Go thy way, thou art too faithful to thy master.
Truly you have objected to me a good reproach.
Thou hast deserved punishment.
'Tis not meet that thou shouldst open those letters which I carry.
Neither oughtst thou to bring such a mischief upon all Greece.
Thou strivest in vain, Menelaus, for I will not deliver my letters to thee.
Thou shalt not pass with them.
I will not leave them behind me.
If thou wilt not deliver them to me, I will break thy head with my mace.
I pass not for that, for I think it a good thing to die in my master's cause.
Oh, thou froward fellow, deliver me thy letters, and make no more business here.
Help, O Agamemnon, I suffer injury here of Menelaus, for with strong hands he hath taken away your letters, and he passeth not of honesty, nor yet of right.
How? What business and contention is there amongst you?
I ought rather to tell the matter than you, Menelaus.
What have you to do, Menelaus, with my servant? Or what cause have you to strive with him, and to take away that which pertaineth to me?
Turn towards me, I pray you, that I may tell you all the matter.
Think you that I, the son of Atreus, am afraid to look upon the Menelaus?
Seest thou, O Agamemnon, these thy letters which contain thy crafty counsel?
See them very well, but thou shalt not keep them long.
Surely I will not deliver to thee before that I have showed them unto the whole house.
Oh, wilt thou desire to know what that which doth not become thee? And tearest thou open the seals of my letters?
As soon as I had opened thy letter, I marvelled what mischief had put those things in thy mind, which thou hast privily declared in this letter.
Where didst thou get my letter?
I took them from your servant, but I, watching by the host to hear of your daughter's coming, by chance met with him.
Do you think it meet that you should know of my matters? I pray you, is this not a token of a naughty and unshamefast man?
It was my pleasure so to do, for I know owe no duty to thee.
Think you that I can suffer this so grievous a thing? That I should neither do my business nor yet rule mine own house after my fancy?
Surely you change your mind oftentimes. For some time you think one thing, and by again you are in another mind.
Oh, indeed. You file your words well. But a learned tongue disposed to evil is a naughty thing.
Yea, and an unconstant and divers mind is as evil. But now I will overcome you with your own words, if you will not deny them for anger, for I will not speak them greatly for your praise. Do you not remember that when you desired to be made captain over the Grecians, you seemed to refuse it, although indeed you wished for it? How lowly then did you show yourself, taking every man by the hand, and keeping open household, and saluting every man after his degree, as though you would have bought your honour with the goodwill of the people? But as soon as you had obtained this honour, you began to change your conditions, for you refused the friendship of them, which had showed themselves friendly to you afore, and then you waxed proud, keeping yourself secretly within your house. But it doth not become a good man to change his fashions after that he is in honour, for he ought then to be more faithful to his friends when he is in place to do them pleasure. I have objected this reproach unto you, because I myself have had proof of it. After that you, with the whole host, were come to this haven, you were careless. But when you could have no passage over the sea, and the Grecians desired license to go home, refusing to spend their time idly here, then you, being wonderfully troubled, fearing lest an evil report should rise of you, because you, being captain over 1,000 ships, could not overcome Troy, you ask counsel of me, what you have to do, that you have neither loose dignity, nor yet dishonour your name. Wherefore, as soon as Calchas the prophesier had answered that the Grecians should both pass the sea quietly, and also conquer Troy, if your daughter were sacrificed to the goddess Diana, then you were very glad, and promised of your own accord to give your daughter to be sacrificed, and being not compelled by any power, you sent unto your wife your daughter, feigning that she should be married to Achilles. But now, suddenly, you have changed your mind, and have written other letters, saying that you will not agree to the death of your own child. Take heed that you do not deny this, for the heaven itself can bear witness of your sayings. Truly, this same doth happen to divers other men, which in the beginning, when they take any weighty matter in hand, do labour very diligently till they have obtained it, and then they leave it off, shamefully, which shame doth chance sometimes through the fearfulness of the subjects, and sometimes when they do rule the commonwealth, which are unmeet for it. But now I do chiefly lament the state of the unfortunate Grecians, which, when they took in hand a noble enterprise against barbarians, are constrained through your occasion and your daughters with great dishonour to leave the same. Wherefore, truly, I think that no captain ought to be chosen for dignity, nor yet for favour, but rather for wit. For he that should rule an host ought in wisdom to excel all other.
Surely it is a grievous thing that one should fall out with another, but specially that any contention should be among brethren.
Now I will tell you of your faults, Menelaus, but in few words, lest I should seem to be unshamefast. Wherefore I will speak to you as it becometh one brother to another. Tell me, I pray you, why do you sigh so? Who hath done you any injury? Do you lament the taking away of your wife? But we cannot promise to get her again for you yourself have been the occasion of your own trouble. Wherefore, seeing I have not offended you, there is no cause that I should suffer punishment for that which I am not guilty of. Doth my preferment trouble you? Or else doth the desire of your beautiful wife vex you? For evil men divers times have such like desires, and although truly I am to blame for that I have not better determined my matters, yet I fear me lest you are much more to be reprehended, for that you being delivered of an evil wife cannot be contented.
These sayings truly do not agree with that which was spoken before. Yet, notwithstanding, they do teach us well that we ought not willingly to hurt our children.
Alas, I, wretch, have never a friend.
Yes, you have divers friends, except you will neglect them.
But it doth become friends to lament one with another.
If you would have friends, you were best to love them, whom you desire to help, and not them whom you would hurt.
Why? Do you not think that Greece needeth help in this matter?
Yes, but I think both that both you and Greece are also bewitched of some god.
Brother, methinks you are too proud of honour. Wherefore I must seek some other way, and get me other friends.
Oh, Agamemnon, thou valiant captain, I have brought to thee Iphigenia, thy daughter, whom thou didst send for. And with her is come Clytemnestra, thy wife, and Orestes, that thou mightst be comforted with sight of them. I have made haste to bring you this news, because I see all the Grecians waiting for the coming of your daughter, as if it were some strange thing. And some of them say that you have sent for her because you are desirous to see her. Others judge that she should be married, and some thinketh that she should be sacrificed to the goddess Diana. Tell me, O king, I pray thee, to whom should she be married? But now let us leave to speak of such things, for it is need and time to prepare that which shall be necessary for the wedding. Wherefore I pray you, Menelaus, be also merry, for this day, as I trust, shall be very fortunate to Iphigenia.
Thou hast said well. Wherefore go thou in, for all things will chance happily to thee. What shall I say, which am thus in trouble, and yet may not bewail my own misery for this occasion? They which are of mean estate seem unto me very happy, for they may complain of their misery and bewail with tears the death of their children. But to noble men no such thing is granted. For I dare not lament my unfortunate chance, and yet it grieveth me that I may not show my misery. Wherefore I know not what I should say unto my wife, nor with what face I should look upon her. Alas, she hath undone me because of her coming. Although indeed she thinketh that she hath a good occasion, for she believeth that her daughter shall be married. In which thing she shall find me a liar. Again, I have pity of the little girl, for I know she will speak thus unto me, "Oh, father, will you kill me? If you forsake me, of whom shall I ask remedy? Oh, alas, what answer shall I make to this? Surely nature ought to move me to pity. And if that would not, yet shame should let me. Oh, alas! Alas, what great reproach is it? The father to be an occasion of his own child's death. How, therefore, am I troubled? On this part, pity and shame. On the other side, honour and glory doth much move me.
We also lament your chance, so much as it becometh women to lament the misery of princes.
I pray you, brother, let me see your hand.
I give you liberty, for I will put all victory in your hand.
I will not flatter you, brother, but I will show you faithfully my opinion. Surely, when I saw you in such misery, I was moved with brotherly pity and lamented much your chance. Wherefore now I counsel you not to slay your daughter, neither to do yourself any damage for my cause. For it is not meet that through my occasion you should hinder either yourself or any of your children. For I, weighing the matter, considering what a grievous thing it is to kill your own child, and besides this, I pity much her, because I do consider she is my kinswoman, and hath not deserved to die for Helen's cause. Wherefore, I will counsel you not to sacrifice your daughter, but rather to send home again the whole host. And as for my part, I will agree unto you. For I, considering how a father ought to love his child, have changed clean my opinion, for I know a good man ought to follow that which is good.
Oh, Menelaus, you have spoken like a nobleman.
I praise you, Menelaus, because you have changed your mind so gently.
Surely ambition and desire of wealth have caused much strife between brethren. Albeit I do abhor such cruel brotherhood.
Although you are agreed, yet I am compelled to slay my daughter.
Why, nobody will compel you?
Yes, truly. The whole host will require her of me.
If you will send her home again, you need not deliver her to the Grecians.
If I should deceive them here, then they would punish me when I come home.
You ought not truly to fear so much the host, for they know not of this matter.
But I doubt lest Calchas show them of it.
You may remedy that in punishing him.
Brother, do you not fear Ulysses?
Yes, truly, for it doth lie in his power to hurt either you or me.
I doubt that, for he studieth very much to get the goodwill and favour of the people.
He is desirous indeed of ambition and honour.
If he should gather the people together and declare unto them what Calchas has said of my daughter, surely he might quickly persuade them to slay you and me, that they would get her the easier. But if it should chance that I should fly, then surely they would not only seek to destroy me, but also my children. Now, therefore, seeing that I am in such trouble that I know not what to do, I shall desire you, O Menelaus, not to show this news unto my wife before that Iphigenia be already sacrificed, that I may be less moved with her piteous complaint. And I pray you also, O ye women, not to open this matter.
Truly we may see now that they are most unhappy, which being neither in too high estate nor yet oppressed with too much poverty, may quietly enjoy the company of their friends. But behold, here cometh Clytemnestra the queen, and Iphigenia her daughter, being adorned with all nobles. Let us therefore meet her with much mirth, lest she should be abashed at her coming into a strange country.
This truly is a token of good luck, that so many noble women meet us. Let us therefore come down from our chariot, that they may bring us to Agamemnon's lodging.
I pray you, mother, be not offended with me, though I do embrace my father.
O King Agamemnon, I am come hither to fulfill your commandment in that you sent for me.
And I also, O father, am come being not a little joyous that I may see you.
Neither am I sorry of your company, daughter, for of all my children, I love you best.
What is the cause, father, that you seem to be so sad, seeing you say you are so joyful at our coming?
You know, daughter, that he which ruleth a host shall have diverse occasions to be troubled.
Although indeed a captain over an host shall be disquieted with sundry causes, yet I pray you set aside all such troubles, and be merry with us, which are therefore come unto you.
I will follow your counsel, daughter, for I will rejoice as long as I may have your company.
But what meaneth this, father, that you do lament so?
I have good cause to mourn, for after this day I shall not see you again, of a great while.
do not understand, O father, what you mean by this.
Truly, daughter, the more wittily you speak, the more you trouble me.
If it be so, father, then will I study to seem more foolish that you may be delighted.
Surely I am constrained to praise greatly your wit, for I do delight much in it.
I pray you then, father, set away all other business and tarry amongst us your children.
Oh, indeed, I am desirous so to do. I cannot as yet have liberty.
What is the matter, father, that you tarry here so long in this haven?
And truly, we are desirous to go hence, but we can have no passage.
Where, I pray you, dwell those people which are called the Trojans?
They are under the kingdom of Priamus.
I would to God I might go with you into those parts.
I will grant you your request, daughter. For I am determined to take you with me.
Shall I go alone, or else with my mother?
No, truly, you shall have neither the company of me, nor yet of your mother.
Why? Will you set me in a strange house?
Leave to inquire of such things. It is not lawful that women should know them.
Make haste, O father, to go unto Troy, that you may come quickly again from thence.
So I do, daughter. But I must sacrifice first.
Shall I be at the sacrifice, father?
Yea, daughter. You must be one of the chiefest.
Why? Shall I dance about it?
Truly, I count myself more happy because you do not understand me. Go your way, therefore. I make you ready with the other virgins. But first, let me take my leave of you. This day shall separate you and me far asunder. Although this your marriage shall be very noble, yet truly it doth grieve me to bestow you so far off, whom with such care I have brought up.
Although you are somewhat troubled, yet I am not of so slender a wit, but that I can easily be persuaded, seeing that both the custom and also time doth require. But tell me, I pray you, shall not Achilles be my daughter's husband?
Yes, truly.
He is a meet marriage indeed, but I am desirous to know where he dwelleth.
His dwelling is about the flood of Phidna.
When, I pray you, shall the wedding be?
Oh, truly, very shortly, for we make haste to go hence.
If it be so, then you have need to sacrifice that which must be done before the wedding.
I will go about it, therefore, that the marriage may be done the quicker.
Where, I pray you, shall the feast be?
Here, but because of the host.
Show me, I pray you, the place, that I may be partaker of it.
I pray you, wife, obey me in this matter.
What cause have you, O king, to say so? For when did I ever disobey you?
I am determined to marry my daughter here.
Shall not I, being her mother, be at the wedding?
No, truly. She shall be married among the Grecians.
Where then shall I tarry?
It is best for you to go again to Greece.
If I leave my daughter behind me, who shall then be in my stead?
Truly, I will do your office, for it doth not become you to be amongst such a company of men.
Although that it be not meet indeed, yet the mother ought to be at the marriage of the daughter.
But I think you have more need to be amongst your other daughters at Greece. Make you ready, therefore, to go home.
I will not go home yet, for you ought to do sacrifice only. But I must see all things made ready for the marriage.
I have laboured in vain. For although I have used deceit and craft, yea, unto my dearest friends, yet I cannot fulfil my purpose.
Where is Agamemnon, the captain of the Grecians, or who of his servants will call him unto me? For I, being moved with the piteous complaints of the people, am compelled to inquire of their captains the cause. Why are they being constrained to forsake both their wives, their children, and also their country, now lie here idly without any valiant deeds doing?
As soon as I heard your voice, O Achilles, I came out hastily to meet you.
What woman is this that seemeth so beautiful?
I do not marvel, though you know not me, whom you never saw. Yet nevertheless, I must needs praise your shamefastness.
Who are you, I pray you, that you, being a woman, dare come amongst such a company of men?
My name is Clytemnestra, and I am the daughter of Leda and the wife of Agamemnon.
You have declared very well in few words what you are, and although you be a noble one, yet it is not lawful for me to tarry here.
Whither go you, I pray you, let us shake hands together, for I trust this marriage shall be very fortunate unto you.
It is not lawful that I should be so familiar with Agamemnon's wife.
Yes, truly, you may well enough, seeing you shall marry my daughter.
I do not know what marriage you mean, except you have heard some news, which, because you know to be untrue, you report as false tale.
I do not marvel, although you will not be acknowing of this marriage, for it is the fashion of all young men to keep it secret for a time.
No, truly, I will not dissemble with you, for indeed I never desired the marriage of your daughter.
If it be so indeed, then I marvel as much of your sayings as you did of mine.
Tell me, I pray you, wherefore have you spoken these things? For it may happen that both of us are deceived.
Think you that it is not a great shame unto me that I have told such a lie? But I will go now. I will now go and know the truth of all this matter.
Tell me, I pray you, or you go hence, where your husband is, for I am very desirous to speak with him.
Tarry, I pray you, O Achilles, for I must speak both with you and also with Clytemnestra.
Who does call me so hastily?
It is even I, the servant of Agamemnon.
If you have anything to say to us, come near and tell it quickly without any circumstance, for you need not to doubt us, for I know you have ever served diligently both me and also divers of my ancestors.
Because I have been ever faithful unto you, therefore now I must open unto you a very secret thing. Truly, Agamemnon hath determined to slay Iphigenia, his daughter, in sacrifice.
Surely, I think either you be mad to tell such an unlikely tale, or else, if it be so indeed, Agamemnon to be half out of his wit to agree to such a cruel murder.
No, truly, he is not mad, though indeed he hath played the madman's part.
Wherefore, I pray you, hath he pretended to do so cruel a deed?
Truly, he is compelled to do so, for Calchas, the prophesier, hath answered that the Grecians cannot sail to Troy without the death of your daughter.
If this be true, wherefore then did he feign that she should be married?
That was because you should be the better willing to let her come.
How, I pray you, do you know this?
Agamemnon himself showed me of this thing. For once he did repent himself so much of the consenting to his daughter's death that he was determined to send you another letter by me, which was contrary to the first.
Why did you not deliver them to me?
As I was bringing them, I happened to meet Menelaus, who with violence took them from me.
Hear you this, O Achilles?
Yea, truly, I hear it well, and I pity you much, for I do even abhor this cruel deed of your husband.
Now, therefore, seeing this thing is chanced so unfortunately unto me, I shall most earnestly desire you, O Achilles, to help me now in this misery, for the reproach shall be yours, seeing my daughter being sent for under the colour of your name shall now be slain. Besides this, if you do not help us, we can by no means avoid this mischief, for I alone, being a woman, cannot persuade Agamemnon. And if you forsake us, none shall dare to take our part.
Truly, it is a very troublesome thing to have children, for we are even by nature compelled to be sorry for their mishaps.
My mind is troubled more and more, for I am wonderfully moved with your piteous complaint. Wherefore, seeing you have required help at my hand, I will promise you to deliver both you and your daughter of this misery, if by any means I may withstand the cruel pretense of Agamemnon and his brother. For this matter pertaineth unto me also, because that if she being sent for in my name should be slain, then truly it would turn to no small dishonor to me. For wherefore I am compelled to help your daughter so much as shall lie in my power. Not only for that I am moved with pity, but because it should sound to no little reproach to me if that through my occasion your daughter should be slain.
Surely you have spoken very well and like a noble man. How therefore, I pray you, shall I give you thanks worthy of your deserts? For if I should praise you too much, I fear lest I should move you to hatred rather than to pity. For then you would judge me to be a flatterer, which of all noble men is to be abhorred. Again, if I should give you fewer thanks than you deserve, then I may well be counted unthankful, so that now I doubt what to do. But seeing you so gently have promised me your help, I will submit both me and my daughter under your rule. Wherefore, if it please you, I will send for her hither, that she herself may require help at your hand.
No, truly, I think it not meet that she should come abroad, for surely men would judge evil of her if she should come much amongst company. It is best, therefore, that you keep her at home, and as for my part, truly, I will do as much for her as shall lie in my power. But I think it best that you should prove first if you can persuade her father not to deliver her.
Surely I shall not prevail with him, for he is so fearful that he dareth do nothing without the consent of the whole host.
Although you think you shall not persuade him, yet it is meet that first you should show him what a grievous thing it is to be called the destroyer of his own children. And if he be nothing moved with that, then you may lawfully seek help at other folks' hands.
You have spoken very well. Wherefore will follow your counsel? But tell me, I pray you, where shall I find you, that I may show you what answer he doth make me?
I will tarry here till you come again, for surely if I should go with you, you should be slandered by me.
In all this matter, I will be ruled by you. Wherefore, if I obtain my suit, the thanks shall be yours and not mine. But now here cometh Agamemnon. Shew me, I pray you, therefore what I should answer him if he ask for my daughter, seeing that she maketh such moan.
I am glad that I have met with you, O Clytemnestra, for I have diverse things to talk with you of.
If you have anything to say to me, tell me, I pray you, for I am ready to hear.
First call out my daughter, that she may go with me to the temple of the goddess Diana, for I have prepared all thing ready for the sacrifice.
You have spoken well, though indeed your doings do not agree with your words. But go your ways, daughter, with your father, and take with you your brother Orestes.
Why do you weep and lament so, daughter?
Alas, how should I suffer this trouble, seeing that all mortal men vexed both in the beginning, the midst, and the ending of their misery?
What is the cause that you are all so sorrowful?
I will show you, if you will promise to tell me one thing which I will require.
Yes, truly I will grant you your request. I did think to have asked it of you.
I hear say that you go about to slay your own child.
What you have spoken, those things which you ought neither to say nor yet to think.
Answer me, I pray you, to this question as you promise.
It is not lawful for me to answer you to those things which you ought not to know.
I have not inquired of anything that doth not become me, but take you heed rather, lest you make such an answer as you ought not.
Who hath done you any injury? Or who hath given you cause to say so?
Ask you this question of me, as though your craft could not be perceived?
Alas, I am troubled more and more, for all my secret counsellors now openly declared.
Indeed, I have heard all that, of all that. which you have prepared for your daughter. Yea, and you yourself have partly confessed it in holding your peace.
I am constrained to hold my peace, because I have told you so manifestly that I cannot deny it.
Hearken now, I pray you, therefore, for must needs tell you of your fault. Do you not remember that you married me without the goodwill of all my friends, taking me away with strong hand, after that you had slain my other husband, Tantalus, which cruel deeds my brother Castor and Pollux would have revenged, except Tyndarus, my father, had delivered you out of that peril, so that by his means you did obtain me to be your wife, who, after I was married, never showed myself disobedient unto you in anything. And then I happened to have three sons at one birth, and afterward one daughter. And will you slay her, knowing no just cause why? For if any man should ask of you the cause of the death of your daughter, you would answer for Helen's sake, which can be no lawful cause. For it is not meet that we should slay our own child for a naughty woman's sake, neither destroy those that by nature we ought to love, for their cause only which are hated of all men. Besides this, if you kill my daughter, what lamentation must I needs make, when I shall go home and want the company of her, considering that she was slain by the hands of her own father? Wherefore, if you will not be moved with pity, take heed lest you compel me to speak those things that do not become a good wife. Yea, and you yourself do those things that a good man ought not. But tell me now, I pray you, what good do you obtain by the death of your daughter? Do you look for a fortunate return? Truly, you cannot by this means get that, for that journey cannot end happily, which is begun with mischief. Besides, this surely you shall stir up the gods to anger against you, for they do even hate them that are man-quellers. Again, you cannot enjoy the company of your other children when you come home, for they will even fear and abhor you, seeing that willingly you do destroy your daughter, and you shall not only fall into this mischief, but also you shall purchase yourself the name of a cruel tyrant. For you were chosen the captain over the Grecians to execute justice to all men, and not to do both me and also your children such an injury. For it is not meet that your children should be punished for that which pertaineth not to you. Neither ought I to lose my daughter for Helena's cause, who have never showed herself faithful to her husband.
It is meet, O Agamemnon, that you should follow your wife's counsel, for it is not lawful that a father should destroy his child.
Now, O father, I, kneeling upon my knees and making most humble suit, do most earnestly desire you to have pity upon me, your daughter, and not to slay me so cruelly. For you know it is given to all mortal men to be desirous of life. Again, remember that I am your daughter, and how you seemed ever to love me best of all your children, insomuch that you were wont ever to desire that you might see me married to one worthy of my degree. And I did ever wish, again, that I might live to see you an old man, that you might have much joy both of me and also of your other children. And will you now consent to my death, forgetting both that which you were wont to say, and also what pain you and my mother took in bringing me up, knowing no cause in me worthy of death? For what have I to do with Helena? But now, father, seeing you are nothing moved with my lamentation, I will call hither my young brother Orestes, for I know he will be sorry to see his sister slain. And again, you cannot choose, but you must needs have pity either of him or else of me, considering what a lawful request we do desire. For you know that all men are desirous of life, and there is no wise man, but he will choose rather to live in misery than to die.
I know in what things I ought to show pity, and wherein I ought not.
and I love my children as it becometh a father, for I do not this of myself, nor yet for my brother's sake, rather by compulsion of the host. For the gods have answered that they cannot pass the sea without your death, and they are so desirous to go thither that they care not what trouble and misery they suffer, so that they may see it. Therefore it lieth not in my power to withstand them, for I am not able to make any resistance against them. I am therefore compelled, daughter, to deliver you to them.
Alas, daughter, into what misery are both you and I driven, seeing that your own father will consent to your death?
Alas, mother, this is the last day that ever I shall see you. Oh, unhappy Troy, which hast nourished and brought up that wicked man Paris. Oh, unfortunate Venus, which didst promise to give Helena to him. For you have been the cause of my destruction, though indeed I, through my death, shall purchase the Grecians a glorious victory. Alas, mother, in what an unlucky time was I born, that mine own father, which hath consented unto my death, doth now forsake me in this misery. I would to God that the Grecians had never taken in hand this journey. But methinks, mother, I see a great company of men coming hither. What are they, I pray you?
Truly, yonder is Achilles.
Let me then, I pray you, go hence, that I may hide my face, for I am ashamed.
What cause have you so to do?
Truly, because it was said that I should have been his wife.
Daughter, you must lay away all shamefastness now, for you may use no niceness, but rather prove by what means you may best save your life.
Alas, Clytemnestra, how unhappy art thou, for truly there is great talking of thee in the whole city.
Whereof, I pray you?
Of your daughter, how she shall be slain.
You have brought me very evil news, but tell me, I pray you, doth nobody speak against it?
Yes, I myself have been in danger of my life because I took your daughter's part.
Who, I pray you, dare hurt you?
Truly, the whole host.
Do not your own countrymen of Myrmidon help you?
No, truly, for even they did also speak against me, saying that I was in love with her, and therefore did prefer mine own pleasure above the commodity of my country.
What answer then made you unto them?
I said that I ought not suffer her to be slain, which was reported by her own father that she should have been my wife.
You said well indeed, for Agamemnon sent for her from Greece, feigning that it was for that purpose.
But though I could not prevail against such a multitude of people, yet I will do as much as shall lie in my power for you.
Alas! Then you alone shall be compelled to strive against many.
Do you not see a great company of harnessed men?
I pray God they be your friends.
Yes, truly, that they be.
Then I hope my daughter shall not die?
No, she shall not, if I can help her.
But will there come anybody hither to slay her?
Yea, truly, Ulysses will be here anon with a great company of men to take her away.
Is he commanded to do so, or doth he it but of his own head?
Oh, truly he is not commanded.
Alas, then he hath taken upon him a wicked deed, seeing he will defile himself with the danger and death of my daughter.
Truly, but I will not suffer him.
But if he go about to take my daughter away with strong power, what shall I do then?
You were best to keep her by you, for no, the matter shall be driven to that point.
Hearken, O mother, I pray you unto my words, for I perceive you are angry with your husband, which you may not do, for you cannot obtain your purpose by that means, and you ought rather to have thanked Achilles because he so gently hath promised you his help, which may happen to bring him into great mischief. I would counsel you, therefore, to suffer this trouble patiently, for I must needs die, and will suffer it willingly. Consider, I pray you, mother, for what a lawful cause I shall be slain. Doth not both the destruction of Troy and also the wealth of Greece, which is the most fruitful country of the world, hang upon my death? And if this wicked enterprise of the Trojans be not revenged, then truly the Grecians shall not keep neither their children nor their wives in peace. And I shall not only remedy all these things with my death, but also get a glorious renown to the Grecians forever. Again, remember how I was not born for your sake only, but rather for the commodity of my country. Think you therefore that it is meet that such a company of men being gathered together to revenge the great injury which all Greece hath suffered should be let of their journey for my cause? Surely, mother, we cannot speak against this. For do you not think it to be better that I should die than so many noble men to be let of their journey for one woman's sake? For one noble man is better than 1,000 women. Besides, this seeing my death is determined amongst the gods. Truly no mortal man ought to withstand it. Wherefore I offer myself willingly to death for my country. For by this means I shall not only leave a perpetual memory of my death, but I shall cause also the Grecians to rule over the barbarians, which doth, as it were, properly belong to them. For the Grecians by nature are free, like as the barbarians are born to bondage.
Surely you are happy, O Iphigenia, that you can suffer so patiently all this trouble.
Truly, I would count myself happy if I have obtained the Iphigenia to be my wife. I think thee, O Greece, to be very fortunate because thou hast nourished such a one. For you have spoken very well in that you will not strive against the determination of the gods. Wherefore, I, being not only moved with pity for that I see you brought into such a necessity, but also stirred up with more love towards you, desiring you to have you to my wife, will promise you faithfully to withstand the Grecians as much as shall lie in my power, that they shall not slay you.
Surely I have spoken even as I thought indeed. Wherefore I shall desire you, O Achilles, not to put yourself in danger for my cause, but suffer me rather to save all Greece with my death.
Truly, I wonder greatly at the boldness of your mind, and because you seem so willing to die, I cannot speak against you. Yet, nevertheless, I will promise to help you still, lest you should happen to change your mind.
Wherefore, mother, do you hold your peace, lamenting so within yourself?
Alas, I, wretched creature, have great cause to mourn.
Be of good comfort, mother, I pray you, and follow my counsel, and do not tear your clothes so.
How can I do otherwise, seeing I shall lose you?
I pray you, mother, study not to save my life, for I shall get you much honor by my death.
What, shall not I lament your death?
No, truly, you ought not, seeing that I shall both be sacrificed to the goddess Diana and also save Greece.
Well, I will follow your counsel, daughter, seeing you have spoken so well. But tell me, what shall I say to your sisters from you?
Desire them, I pray you, not to mourn for my death.
And what shall I say unto the other virgins from you?
Bid them all farewell in my name, and pray you for my sake bring up my little brother Orestes till he come to man's age.
Take your leave of him, for this is the last day that you shall see him.
Farewell, my well-beloved brother, for I am even as it were compelled to love you, because you were so glad to help me.
Is there any other thing that I may do for you at Greece?
No, truly, but I pray you not to hate my father for this deed, for he is compelled to do it for the wealth and honor of Greece.
If he hath done this willingly, then truly he hath committed a deed far unworthy of such a noble man as he is.
Who is this that will carry me hence so soon?
I will go with you, O daughter.
Take heed, I pray you, lest you happen to do that which shall not become you. Wherefore, O mother, I pray you, follow my counsel and tarry here still. For I must needs go to be sacrificed unto the goddess Diana.
And will you go away, O daughter, leaving me your mother here?
Yea, surely, mother. I must go from you unto such a place, from whence I shall never come again, although I have not deserved it.
I pray you, daughter, tarry, and do not forsake me now.
Surely I will go hence, mother, for if I did tarry, I should move you to more lamentation. Wherefore I shall desire all you women to sing some song of my death, and to prophesy good luck unto the Grecians. For with my death I shall purchase unto them a glorious victory, bring me therefore unto the altar of the temple of the goddess Diana, that with my blood I may pacify the wrath of the gods against you.
O Queen Clytemnestra of most honour, after what fashion shall we lament, seeing we may not show any token of sadness at the sacrifice?
I would not have you to mourn for my cause, for I will not refuse to die.
Indeed, by this means you shall get yourself a perpetual renown for ever.
Alas, thou sun which art comfort to man's life, O thou light which dost make joyful all creatures, I shall be compelled by and by to forsake you all and to change my life.
Behold, yonder goeth the virgin to be sacrificed with a great company of soldiers after her, whose beautiful face and hair, fair body, anon shall be defiled with her own blood. Yet happy art thou, O Iphigenia, that with thy death thou shalt purchase unto the Grecians a quiet passage, which I pray God may not only happen fortunately unto them, but also that they may return again prosperously with a glorious victory.
Come hither, O Clytemnestra, for I must speak with you.
Tell me, I pray you, what would you with me, that you call so hastily? Is there any more mischief in hand that I must hear of?
I must tell you of a wonder which hath happened at the sacrificing of your daughter.
Show me, I pray you, quickly what it is.
As we went to the place where the sacrifice should be, and passed through the pleasant fields, where the whole host waited for your daughter, Agamemnon, seeing her brought to her death, began to lament and weep. But she, perceiving what moan her father made, said unto him these words, O father, I am come hither to offer my body willingly for the wealth of my country. Wherefore, seeing I shall be sacrificed for the commodity of all Greece, I do desire you that none of the Grecians may slay me privily, for I will make no resistance against you. And when she had spoken those words, all they which were present were wonderfully astonished at the stoutness of her mind. So, after this, Achilles, with the rest of the whole host, began to desire the goddess Diana that she would accept the sacrifice of the virgin's blood, and that she would grant them a prosperous success of their journey. And when they had made an end, the priest, taking the sword in his hand, began to look for a place convenient where he might slay your daughter. Suddenly there chanced a great wonder, for although all the people heard the voice of the stroke, yet she vanished suddenly away. And when all they, marvelling at it, began to give a great screech. Then there appeared unto them a white hart, lying before the altar, struggling for life. And Calchas, being then present, and seeing what had happened, did wonderfully rejoice, and told the captains that this hart was sent of the goddess, because she would not have her altar defiled with the blood of your daughter. Moreover, he said, that this was a token of good luck, and that their journey should chance prosperously unto them. Wherefore he willed that they should tarry no longer here. And when this was so finished, Agamemnon willed me to show all these things unto you, because that I myself was present then. Wherefore, I shall desire you to think no unkindness in the king your husband, for surely the secret power of the gods will save them whom they love. For this day your daughter hath been both alive and dead.
Surely, O Clytemnestra, you ought to rejoice of this news that your daughter is taken up into heaven.
But I am in doubt whether I should believe that thou, O daughter, art amongst the gods, or else that they have feigned it to comfort me.
Behold, yonder cometh Agamemnon, who can tell the truth of all this matter.
Truly, wife, we are happy for our daughter's sake. For surely she is placed in heaven. But now, I think it best that you go home, seeing that we shall take our journey so shortly unto Troy. Wherefore now, fare you well. And of this matter I will commune more at my return. And in the mean season, I pray God send you well to do, and your heart's desire.
O happy Agamemnon, the gods grant thee a fortunate journey into Troy, and a most prosperous return again. And they all lived happily ever after.
apart from those who didn't.
Apart from those who, well, I mean, technically, you know, according to witnesses, nobody died. You know, nobody died. There was some transmogrification into a white hart. You know, that you know, you get all the emotional agony, and then a white hart is there instead. I mean, it's not quite the Abraham and Isaac thing. You know, if it was that, that a white hart would appear in her place, she'd still be there, and they get to sacrifice the white hart in their place. But yeah, you have those sort of parallels. I spent a lot of my time in that last section just thinking of our Lord and Saviour Aslan.
And the great stone table.
Yeah, that's obviously I'll stop talking now. It's a fascinating take on the original play. You know, the structural change done with the chorus there is still really interesting. I mean, this chorus doesn't do very much. Towards the end, the chorus does actually start interacting with people, but the chorus doesn't for most of the play. And a lot of those lines feel like they felt more like just random thoughts and from inside people's heads, like their conscience or their good and bad angel speaking to people at times. It didn't feel like actual separate people a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It was like Lumley's cut down the chorus so much that it's almost not there until the very, very end, when it sort of has a function.
I wouldn't miss the chorus though. I meant that the other way around. I would miss the chorus if it wasn't there. I think it does add a certain an extra dimension to it, having a commentator.
I think there are two things. I think if we were doing this in audio play, it wouldn't be a problem. I think I would seriously not want to give someone the part of this chorus for a stage play. I think they would lose the will to live, and I would
I don't think that would be fair on anyone. You know, even if you could pay them for the full run and, you know, get a decent whack, all the rest of it, it's such a thankless role in this version. Sarah?
I don't know that I agree with you about that. Because actually, I mean, I wasn't here for the first look of this. So I was a little bit surprised when I was reading through it and the chorus being so brief. But I actually think you could do something with this chorus, because some of those early bits of the chorus, they are so brief that you could almost play them in like a deadpan way. That there was one in particular near the beginning. These sayings truly do not agree with that which was spoken before. And it's like, yeah, think. And I think you could almost like play this chorus as a kind of almost an anti-chorus. Like, they're completely unimpressed with what's happening. And like, am I bothered? Whatever. And then as the story goes on, and it's obvious that this young girl is going to be sacrificed, then they get drawn more into her tragedy. But they could maybe actually start from quite a supercilious kind of, Vicky Pollard kind of place. And that could actually turn, you know, what is a traditional Greek chorus into something quite different and quite fun to play, almost, maybe.
So the reason I'm pausing is I'm just actually counting how many lines they actually say in the entire play, which is less than 20. So you know, you're on stage for an hour plus, just reacting. I mean,
but Robert, what about the counsellor in the faun? Who has one blasted line?
They'll be doubled as somebody else, though, Helen. It's not the same problem.
But he's on most of the time. He's on most of the time.
But he is engaged. The chorus doesn't engage with anybody until the end. They don't talk to anyone. They're just there randomly in the background saying words.
They're talking to the audience.
But they're not. It feels really weird. It feels really weird.
The
chorus has been stripped back
great.
So much. And especially several of the lines could be said by other people on stage who are already on stage. I mean, there's a couple of lines Achilles. It feels like actually they should be Achilles lines. I wouldn't be surprised if you go back to the original that they actually were Achilles lines. And other bits and pieces like that. We've gone off obviously on my pet tangent. Feel free to go on other tangents. But we'll go around the room with the hands I see. I see Lynn, I see Elizabeth, and I thought so Eric earlier as well. So I've got Lynn, Elizabeth, Eric.
Yeah, in response to the chorus thing, it's problematic. It's a tricky question. But the chorus in Greek tragedy, and here I think is the public dimension of these events, of these personal decisions. And I think that's really important, that the ripples of this horrible personal dilemma spread out through the whole community, that this is a community concern. And I think that's important. So how do you make that dimension visible if you don't have the chorus? So that's a question. Okay, completely different thought about the ending of the play and the, you know, Lady Lumley's whole decision to translate this. You know, she gets taken up to heaven and everything is, and she doesn't really die, and so. Is this really a positive ending? Because anyone who knows the larger story, which Lady Lumley must have, is that, the Greeks eventually win. They eventually win the Trojan War, but the siege lasts 10 years. Most of them die on the way home. Agamemnon is, and you know, that family tragedy goes on for several generations more, and then eventually the triumphant Greeks are displaced by the descendants of the Trojans, the Romans. So, you know, Greece is on its way to this fabulous victory, only it's very qualified, and it's temporary. And most of the readers of this play would have known that, and is that in the background?
Yeah, and following on from that point, you know, the play does keep bringing on Orestes, you know, this young boy who, you know, is just sort of, you know, there, just this totem of where this story is going later, people. Look, he's just a boy, but they're going to turn him into a man soon. Elizabeth and Eric.
Yeah, I just had a brief point about the ineffectual nature of Achilles in this. You know, I just felt that he was like, oh, I'll help you, Clytemnestra, I'll help you. As whatever is in my power to do, I'll do. And then he kind of does nothing. He doesn't do anything at all. And then there's this whole thing where they say, oh, Ulysses will be coming with his host as well. And he doesn't ever seem to turn up. I don't know if that was me, but I thought I saw Ulysses was a name drop there. But I just thought it was interesting how ineffective the male characters are in this and how much agency the female characters have in this. So it seemed to me that Clytemnestra seemed to be the only one that's really there trying to save Iphigenia, trying to save her from her fate.
Agamemnon's initial plot, you know, how can I save my daughter? I'll write a letter. That'll solve the problem. You know, it's not like no, you know, and put, you know, he's sort of the way he boxes almost himself in as well. Eric, then Helen.
Yeah, it's interesting how like the point about, well, I'll just reply to Elizabeth's point and then sort of get back to the chorus thing. I think it's also a stylistic thing of Euripides, like the original, to write sort of very strong female characters because they're not anything like the men in these stories. I mean, you know, like Medea or, you know, Iphigenia or, you know, loads of other stuff. It's interesting how basically in the original story and in like sort of this myth version, Achilles is supposed to be the most powerful hero. He's supposed to be like sort of, I mean, he's, you know, the most powerful Greek, but he can't do anything. He can't do squat about this situation supposedly because the gods have decided it and so on and so forth. But I mean, it's interesting to see that hierarchy and play out as well. Also, regarding the chorus, there's a part of me going, I don't know if the chorus, because it would be more than one person, so you could just switch people in, I guess. I don't know how that would work, but like if you could have like, because it's a chorus of women, so you wouldn't have just one person. Yes, we are here, the women are, yeah. I don't know, it's an interesting decision to see how it plays out in terms of with one person, I mean with like 10 people speaking just those one-liners. Also, I guess one-liners are probably easier to say with 10 other people to coordinate. Rather than going, you know, a huge wall of text. But I think maybe the original chorus was probably more effective, actually, which is kind of weird considering we usually don't like choruses.
Well, this is the thing. Having cut so much of the chorus, there is the point of sort of going, well, you kind of, why not just go all the way? I mean, it's this tokenistic chorus that remains seems interestingly odd. And it's the big textual change that Lumley makes to the overall. I think the rest of the changes are very minor textual adjustments or things that happened in the translation. That's the big structural thing where you're going, there should be a massive speech here, and there isn't. And all of those bits have basically gone, and it's everything involving the chorus. So it's interesting that removing the chorus till it's almost homeopathic, but not actually fully removing the chorus, and it's one of those it is a big thing. I mean, I say certainly for an audio version, it is not a problem keeping the chorus. In fact, it's very useful. The chorus acts as a narrator figure, but there is also a question of whether actually the chorus / Senex / Nuncius, whether there is some crossover that could be done with those kind of characters who are outside of the action, but are involved in the action in some way. Helen.
Yes, I rather disagree about Achilles. I mean, I saw him as being fairly clear in his line. His honour is engaged because his name, although without his consent, has been used in the ruse to get Iphigenia there. Therefore, he is, whether he wishes to be or not, her champion, and he ought to try and save her. But the moment she consents to be a sacrifice, he has no further duty in this. So it's Iphigenia's consent changes matters for Achilles, I think. I mean, that was the impression I got, that his honour is no longer engaged because she doesn't mind. Or even if she does mind, she's willing to put up with it.
Yeah, and I also quite like that there is this moment of humour. There aren't that many moments of humour in this, but when he turns up and says, oh, so you're marrying my daughter. What? I'm doing the what now? there's a nice little moment of you know, not. I'm not talking that this is hilarious or anything, but it's a moment that might have some levity in a play that is, by and large, quite serious. It's nice to have a little bit.
Talking of levity, though, the more I read of Nuntius, the scene, the descriptive scene, speech about Iphigenia's sacrifice, the more I read of it, the more I was hearing Stanley Holloway, which was probably the wrong way to go.
I quite like it.
It did sound very much like his narrative style.
Well, it is a storytelling thing. I mean, that's the thing, is you do need to lean into the storytelling element of those speeches as well.
I felt it needed a lot of big gestures.
Yeah,
that speech, which don't really work on Zoom.
And of course, in production, you can make a decision. Do you have Iphigenia doing her own dialogue? You know, is there a little dumb show? You know, demonstrate. You know, you can do all sorts of little elements with that. To play with that. We've discussed that with many classical and neoclassical works.
He may have recorded her on his smartphone. He could just play it for her.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. No, I've written a blog post. It's fine. You can just read it there. I'm off. Eric.
I happen to find I say original version, at least one version that has been edited into, like, you know, preciustufts.edu and so on and so forth, which is like the sort of, you know, classical go-to database. And the choruses do seem to be that short for at least half the play, which is quite an interesting note, I guess. Sort of, you know, like two-liners even in classical Greek, which is kind of, I mean, two-liners in classical Greek, maybe like four lines in English, but yeah.
Oh, within the scenes themselves, but not the in-between chorus song and dance routines, presumably.
I don't know. I haven't found any like in-between chorus things.
There definitely were last time. I was following along. That's the big difference. It's like the scenes. There are some scenes where someone exits and effectively comes straight on again, and it's because there's a chorus bit, basically.
Yes, the sacrifice didn't seem to take nearly long enough. I mean, there should have been a much longer chorus there, I felt. Mm. 1 minute she was setting off for the sacrifice, and next minute it was being narrated.
Yeah, and that chorus does feel very much like narration. It's, and now the time has passed. Moment.
Of course, I said that and then just found this huge ball of text that titled chorus.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, my apologies, misinforming people.
I think Lumley was very concerned with just getting on with the plot, not doing the reflection stuff. And you know, I suppose it makes sense. Okay, right. Well, we're towards the end of the session. Just go around the room for final thoughts. How we found it this time? I remember the first time we read it, there was a lot more struggling, as I recall. I think it flowed a bit better this time. I could be wrong. That could be an entirely false memory, by the way. But yeah, any final thoughts from the room? Helen, any final thoughts from you about the play overall?
Well, I thought it sped through. It was very focused. Agamemnon wasn't quite as wet as I remembered him, but that was no doubt the speaking. He was genuinely distressed, not just, oh God, oh God, oh God, this is an awful situation. Why do I have to deal with it? So, I think it's a neat little play. Whether it's playable is another matter altogether.
I do have a few reservations about it as a live show. I mean, that's my primary objection with the way the chorus has been treated in this version. I think it would make perfectly good audio. I think it would actually works very well for audio because we've got all these little bits of narration that work very well of telling us who's what's happening between things. So I think, yeah. But maybe people disagree. Maybe people think it has more legs. We don't have that much Greek translation in the early modern, so it's quite nice to have it in whichever form. Lynn, any final thoughts?
Not really. My thought about, I wonder how much of the irony of we're headed for a big Greek victory is at play here. But yeah, like Helen, I wouldn't want to pronounce on whether or not this is something someone should aspire to stage. Don't have an answer to that.
Well, yeah, ultimately we will. I'm sure we'll do it. It's actually quite high up on the list. So it's not an if, it's just really when and how we program it. Elizabeth, any final thoughts?
I really enjoyed it. I'm not sure if I enjoyed it as much as Englishman for My Money, which is the other play that we did in the afternoons this week. But I do agree that it's very difficult to see this, how this would be performed. I kind of got a sense of that they would have to have lots of like projections on the screen and lots of like physical theatre and lots of kind of maybe sort of dramatic techniques to kind of bring it out to life. But listening to it's lovely. And I really like the long speeches. I thought that they worked very, very well. So listening to it is just brilliant. And so I think it would work best as an audio.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any terrors about staging something like this because it's basically just a slightly simplified version of Greek tragedy. And, that happens, reasonably frequently. I mean, apart from the absence of much of a chorus, but a lot of modern productions of Greek tragedy, if they don't dispense with the chorus, they don't do them particularly chorusy, singy, dancey as the ancient Greek tragedy would have done. They tend to stand around in suits and say words. So in many ways, I think this slots perfectly well into a modern performance context quite well. I think there are a few slightly clumsy phrasings. I think there's some micro edits I might make. But otherwise, in terms of actually the way you stage it, I've done this kind of thing quite a few times. It's quite cheap as well. I like things that are cheap. You may have noticed that about me. I don't know if I've ever brought this up. Alan, any final thoughts?
I think it worked well at pace. I'm not a great fan of the multiple reworkings that we've come across over time of the Trojan War, the Greek myths, and that whole general area of literature. So I'm not exactly an impartial judge. It's fairly well ploughed soil. But it worked in parts, I think.
Eric, any final thoughts? Are you mortally offended at the destruction of ancient Greek literature?
No, it's I'm just fascinated by there's a part of me going, I want to compare these kind of texts to texts like Jocasta by George Gascoigne or like other translations of classical Greek tragedy into, or translations and adaptations, just because I think that his language is also, obviously this is by a female playwright, author, translator, but not sure what title to give her.
It is one of those borderline, you know, adapter slash translator. Yes.
Yeah, and just kind of, it's like interesting to see the differences in language used that way, sort of, and obviously what they focus on. I mean, sort of, yeah. Just I do like Gascoigne's translations also. I might be a bit biased there, but yeah. But we only have the one of this, so yeah, of Lady Lumley's.
This is true. Rachel, I don't think I've gone to you. Any final thoughts?
I don't know if it'll work for, you know, staging or anything like that, but I thought it was enjoyable. I don't know. I enjoy the character of Clytemnestra. Yeah.
Good. Alan.
Yeah, just a quick question. I think we maybe did touch on this in the first look, was whether this was actually any evidence of this ever being staged, or whether this was something that was done for closet performance.
We don't have any stage performance history for it, and the way it's structured, it doesn't look like it's designed that way either, because there are several minor sort of entry and exit issues. You know, the way it's been adjusted by removing the chorus, it's made it harder to stage, because the chorus is quite useful for facilitating changes of action. Eric,
yeah, I was going to say, well, like, this translation is interesting, but also it's a lot shorter than Pilabidarum Secunda.
It is.
Which is just epically long. But that sort of, it feels like, you know, you could use them as a framing device for each other, which is kind of weird, but yeah.
Oh, that's part of my thinking, is that there's different ways of selling productions of these. You know, there is a ancient Greece in translation angle, which might work. This does act as a nice sort of prologue to Pelopidorum Secundum, which is a whole different kettle of fish as to how stage worthy that is. I mean, this is very, you know, perfectly stage worthy. It's basically Greek tragedy. It's got a few minor changes. So, you know, if you think you can stage Greek tragedy, then it's perfectly stage worthy. It's fine. It's just, there's some. How much has it fired our imaginations, and how much fun was Agamemnon? Agamemnon's rather a good part as well, actually, I have to say. Sarah, how was that, and any thoughts about the play?
Yes, I have lots of thoughts about the play. I really enjoyed it. I think it's eminently stageable and performable as an audio. I mean, obviously, yeah, you've got so much narration, you've got so many great word pictures there that it lends itself to audio, because it's the kind of thing that the listener would have no trouble creating in their mind. I also would love to see it staged. You see, the thing that I find fascinating about, I know nothing about ancient Greek drama, but the thing that I find fascinating about this is the fact that it's an early modern translation, and it's a translation by a woman. And so if I was going to stage this, I'd really want to play up those aspects of this. You know, this is not necessarily the best translation of the original Euripides. I have no idea, because I've literally no idea about Greek tragedy, but you could, you know, it wasn't written to be performed, so you could stage it in a sort of closet type environment, and I would actually like put everybody in. I mean, I don't know quite when it was translated, but like, say for the sake of argument, it's Elizabethan, which I'm kind of assuming it is. I'd put everybody in Elizabethan costume. And actually really play up the fact that this is an early modern translation of Euripides, and this was a translation by a woman. So I would even maybe have the figure of Lady Lumley playing the chorus, You know, she could be there, sitting at her desk in a corner, muttering to herself, writing with her pen, while the actors are there, you know, creating this quite maybe stylized Elizabethan version of this, you know, Greek tragedy. Because, I mean, you're right, you know, Greek tragedy gets done a lot. It's kind of quite easy to stage. Audiences tend to like it. I think it would be quite cool to do this in a way that actually plays up its differences and says, look at this. This is really interesting because, look, a woman translated this in 15 whatever, and this is the version of it that we have left. So, yeah, I kind of think you could do kind of cool things with this, both on stage and on audio. That excites me. Yeah, and I loved Agamemnon. Thank you for casting this Agamemnon. He was great.
Yeah. Yes, it's slightly pre-Elizabethan. It's 1553-ish. So it's, you know, hop, skip and a jump.
Mary.
Mary, you know, it's close.
Marian, not Elizabethan.
But it's, you know, it's in that area. So yeah, I'm glad. I really like the idea of making Lumley the chorus, because actually then she can start off slightly aloof and then be brought into the action towards the end, and that would work, and that would make that fair. And it means that the actor can stay sitting down for quite a long time, and in fact not have to learn their very few lines, except for the last couple of pages. I really like that. Yes, riff on that. I mean, we have already done not only a first look exploring sessions, but also there is in the works full cast audio adaptations of the translation by Mary Sidney of the Tragedy of Antony, and also the Elizabeth Carey's The Tragedy of Marium. So, you know, there's a season there as well. I mean, I like to play with different options for seasons and look for different options. So, but that as a season is a very, very tight. And there are a few other works as well that might be able to go into the mix there as well. I'll go back to Sarah, then I'll go to Alan.
Cool, thank you. I something else that just occurred to me, if you were doing this as Lumley writing in the corner and the players playing it in Marian costume in a sort of closed environment. So, I mean, obviously you'd need to have an audience in there, but I don't know what the Elizabethan word for drawing room is, but
Great hall.
Like a parlour sort of environment. You could then also at the end, because that's an era, early modern era, we kind of associate it with sort of hunting and, you could actually have Agamemnon come in at the end, reappear at the end with a white deer, fake white deer, with a carcass. And actually, because it would really lend itself to that early modern Tudor period, bang it down in front of Clytemnestra, say, "Hey, everything's fine," and then he goes off, and Lady Lumley's there writing the final chorus speech, happy Agamemnon, and then she puts her pen down, and then you're just left with Clytemnestra, because she has no more dialogue, but she could look at the audience, where I don't know where he's got this from, but this man is a liar and I don't believe a word of it, and kind of leave the audience on Clytemnestra's face, looking really evil after the play is done, after Lumley's put down her pen. That would then actually tie it into the back into the original Greek, the myth cycle. And I don't know, I just think that could be a really good ending, but that's just a thought I've had.
I love that thought. I hope the viewers appreciate it, because I think that's a you see, we've already started building our production. It's fine. Or at least one of our productions. Other ideas are available. Alan, then Rachel.
I must admit, I was getting mental images at times of the chorus actually being Waldorf and Statler sitting at the box at the side of the stage.
They're a bit too much cheerleady sometimes for that to work. Mm-hmm. Of going, this is a great thing that is happening here, unless of course they're speaking ironically. Which
I think there is an amount of irony in here which we've not possibly explored.
Mm. Rachel.
Yeah, to what Sarah said about leaving it on that note with Clytemnestra wanting revenge. For I was finding that. For me, asking as through the lines for her to get revenge, even bringing Orestes in, like, come in and see what her father is going to do to me or something, that maybe if production wanted to bring that in and make it something like that, like, for the honor of the family, she has to go and do this. But there is that, I guess, kind of beating of the drum and, like, younger brother take up revenge, or somebody take up revenge for this. I don't know.
Helen.
Orestes doesn't have any lines, does he?
No, he's just a child.
Yeah. I mean, the point about Orestes is that he's going to kill Clytemnestra.
Mm. Yeah.
Not that he's going to kill Daddy. He's going to kill Mummy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because Mummy kills Daddy.
Mm.
Yes.
So, I mean, the whole thing gets... It's very difficult to give Orestes any feelings, but he's obviously far more fond of Daddy than he is of Mummy. And however much his sister may love him, he loves Daddy more. Or at any rate, his honour tells him he should.
Yeah.
Eric?
I was just going to be cheeky and say, you could stage this in Cyprus, because there's an international ancient Greek drama festival every year, so.
Oh, neat!
Mm.
Because of course there is.
And also in various languages. So, like, I've seen like performances in Italian with like subtitles and like, or super titles, and like sort of German and then that kind of thing.
I suppose that there are productions in classical Greek too, untranslated. I bet they do that. Yes. Tell me they do that.
So it depends. I mean, I've seen like
modern Greek.
Yeah, usually. Mostly modern Greek.
But see, and they're very different, aren't they? My understanding is that native Greek speakers can't read classical Greek.
Well, it depends. It's sort of it can be very challenging, I guess. But it doesn't really make sense to classical Greek speakers. To Greek speakers, modern Greek speakers.
It's like if you're Italian, you don't necessarily read Latin. I mean, you recognize a lot of the words, but...
Yeah. No, the structure is very different. It's very...
Okay. Stop me before I get really language geeky. Before I start talking about inflections and stuff. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think we've possibly reached the end of this particular stage of things. There isn't fundamentally anything with this text of going, we would do a third look with editorial interventions. I think we found our route into it, and that's basically to just get some actors. So that's the next stage for that. It's relatively swift in the probability of ending up as an audio drama, but also one day when we can go on out into stages, we might do it in some kind of live context, and that would be quite nice to do. Lynn?
Yeah, and I'm sure this has occurred to you, but Senex and Nuntius don't need to be two different people. Like, that can be one.
Hmm.
That can be the same actor.
Yeah. Certainly they can double. And if you're doing it as a season with other plays, then if some people have less to do, then it's less of a problem. In fact, if you've someone who had a massive part in the tragedy of Mariam can slum it as Lady Lumley the next time. At least they get a decent credit on their CV. All that remains is to thank all the wonderful readers for all their wonderful reading. Thank you very much, and goodbye.